This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Anna Lindner, your host, and today we are going to be talking to Dr. Jose Fernandez. Dr. Jose Fernandez is an assistant professor in the Latina, Latino, or Latinx studies program at the University of Iowa. He teaches courses in Latin studies and Latin literature in the United States. His book, Against Marginalization, Convergences in Black and Latinx Literatures, which we will discuss today, compares episodes in Black and Latinx literary histories, interpreting the emergence of both literary traditions as a fight for social, cultural, and artistic recognition. Dr. Fernandez, thanks so much for coming on today.
Hi, Annette. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Yeah. Really excited to talk about your book today. And before we get into it, I just wanted to give you a chance to kind of discuss, you know, the background of this book, how it happened, why you wrote it, and maybe even some of your background, where you went to school, where you grew up, just in the types of things that affected the writing of this book.
Sure. Probably I'll start with my background and then I'm going to move to my academic background. I grew up in Mexico City. Then when I was 18 years old, I went to a small school, Northeastern Illinois University, and I was an ESL student, so I learned English, a second language. I was always interested in English, like learning the language, reading, and learning about the culture. In the literature. So when I started college, I toyed with the idea of a science major, but then I decided to go into English. I got my BA in English literature, my master's, and then I went to grad school to Northern Illinois University, sorry. And that's where I was always interested in literature, American literature. I remember like filling up the gaps in my knowledge. So I went to high school in Mexico. And when I started to take in English classes, it was like I was hearing about all these American authors and the literary tradition that I wasn't familiar. So that was filling in the gaps with American literature. But then I remember being particularly interested in reading African-American or Black authors. But there was seldom the opportunity when I went to college in the early 2000s. I remember waiting like two semesters to take an African-American literature course. But then I had more opportunities as I moved out into my degrees for reading different periods. So it might have been during my PhD studies when I had the opportunity to immerse in African-American literature and made it one of my areas of specialization and part of my comp exams along American literature. So I came to Latinx literature, Latino literature, very late into grad school. I didn't have a lot of opportunities to take Latinx literature courses. And once I started teaching in the early 2010s, that's when I had the opportunity to, again, filling in the gaps with Chicanx, Latinx literature, and then teaching classes. And then I started teaching classes in African-American literature, Latinx literature, American literature. And that's probably the origin of the project. I came from all this background on African-American literature. And then when I started reading about Latinx literature, I started getting pieces, bit and pieces of from scholars in anthologies when I mean, there were clearly points of similarities between the literature and the histories, but that was the origin of this project, actually, who took several years to complete.
Yeah, I'm sure. Book length work is always a very long labor that develops over years and years. Great. And kind of just before we really get into things, as people who are listening probably know, there's a lot of controversy over the last 10 years around the terms, you know, Latina, Latino, Latinx, Latine, et cetera. And you kind of discussed this briefly at the beginning of the book. Could you talk a little bit about the terms that you use, if you use particular terms in particular situations, and then how you kind of developed that decision, where you're coming from, and why you think a certain term is best?
Sure. Thanks for asking the question. In the book, you're right, or I remember, like, there are certain sections in the book when I needed to start with the terminology. And one of the ways I took to think about a terminology that was helpful for me, and I tried to incorporate it in the book, is how, in the context of literature, cultural production, terms to describe communities of color, people of color, minoritized communities, has been through, it evolved. And scholars talk about this process, like you mentioned, it has to be contextualized in a certain particular period and looking at social events. So I remember reading or looking at anthologies in African-American literature that began as Negro literature at the turn of the 20th century, then in the 60s and 70s, Afro-American, then African-American, and then Black. And I think Black is one of the terms that have remained somehow contents. And in the in relation to Latinx literature, I notice, or I want to believe, that it was a certain process in terminology related with cultural production. And that's what I tried to do in the book, focus on how can we look at a body of a group of authors, a body of literature, in the case, for example, in Latino literature, that often has been described from different perspectives, or like the experience of different groups, Puerto Ricans, Dominican Americans, Cuban Americans. And the way I decided to tackle that is think about those groups as not homogeneous, but more as what would be a way to like incorporate this body of work from authors who have been traditionally underrepresented, marginalized, and make it into Latino, Latina, Latinx. And I know, I'll say briefly, I understand like the resistance to some of these terms, the idea of Latinx in certain contexts, in certain communities. And that's something that when I teach Intro to Latinx Studies, or I've been teaching Intro to Latinx Studies recently, the students, Latino students or not Latino students, they're new to those terms. Sometimes as a group, we think this terms may serve a purpose in our case in the context of academia, but when we go outside, the experience of different groups may be very different, and that's probably one of the moments when these terms become more it's harder to agree upon, like what terminology to use.
Definitely, Latinx is the one that I'm seeing now, I would say, in the academic community, definitely. And this is kind of a question of semantics and etymologies and all of that. But I think your point about trying to use the particular when you're outside of the academy makes sense to me, especially when you're talking about particular people. And speaking of that, your book revolves around the idea that Black and Latinx communities have experienced similar struggles. And I'm wondering how you're balancing kind of comparing the marginalization that they've experienced, but then also acknowledging the differences in their experiences, and how you do that throughout the book.
Thank you. The way probably I try also, going back to the structure of the book, as I develop some of these ideas or think through those, like you say, these similar periods or similar characteristics in relation to the marginalization of different groups. When I began this project and when I started doing research or trying to write about African American authors, the history of the struggle of African American authors was more apparent because of like the social, economic, or historical reasons. But although I wasn't like make a parallel with the struggles, I was noting that some of the obstacles, particularly in relation to cultural production, for example, Mexican-American authors in the Southwest at the turn of the 20th century. At the beginning of the project, I didn't realize how much of their struggles or their attempt to be represented in the literature were parallel to like the marginalization or the exclusion of African-American authors. So I think that was, or for me, it remains the important aspect of like the comparisons or points of convergence. Oftentimes, or in my case, I was more familiar with the struggle of African-American authors than with Mexican-American, Latinx, or Latinx authors. So I think what the book tries to do is like look at those struggles comparatively, but I will agree that even within Latinx authors, every time that there's a comparison about the struggles, I could run the risk of minimizing some aspects of that struggle or emphasizing aspect of that struggle that may or may not be in every Latinx author. Probably when it comes to African American authors, it could be more context.
Yeah, that's always the struggle. I feel like going back when you're trying to make comparisons without kind of flattening the things that make them unique. But, you know, obviously your book does a good job of that because you're looking at case studies, very particular case studies. And speaking of that, while everyone that you talk about in this book has experienced and to a degree resisted marginalization, Black and Latinx authors that you talk about in this book are not the kind of perfect social justice warriors who fight for the inclusion of all people in an intersectional way that readers might imagine, right? And that's what we think when we think about, oh, convergences between Black and Latinx authors who are trying to resist marginalization. It's not quite that simple. For example, you talk about Baldwin and Anaya as reluctant spokespersons for civil rights, which I think is a good way of kind of understanding how they were dealing with the pressures of their times. And I just wondered if you could walk us through how you're retaining their social context while also still connecting the struggles that they had to current events, current struggles that communities are dealing with now.
Sure. So for example, in that particular example of Baldwin and NIA, and I completely agree that, for example, the social activism of some contemporary authors of color might look different from the activism or social awareness or fight for social justice from authors of the late 60s and 70s. What was interesting to me, for example, in that discussion of Anaya and Baldwin was based on their training as writers, their artistic vision, their aesthetic choices. They wanted to be artists. They want to be considered artists, but perhaps at that time, mainstream white authors while not doing social activism, so they found it a little bit incompatible. But like you mentioned, it's not because the social issues were not there, or like it's not because there wasn't any need for fight for civil rights. But what I will say about James Baldwin, for example, and a lot of his scholars have written about this, is that although on the one hand, he want to say, I'm an artist, I'm a writer, I'm not an activist. On the other hand, he went out of his way more than a lot of other authors, African-American authors at the time, to fight for those civil rights and be active in travel to the South. And to a degree, it's the same with Anaya. I think, again, based on their artistic vision, they wanted to be perceived as first and foremost as writers, but that also didn't mean that Anaya, when he wrote autobiographical pieces, he talks about his involvement with civil rights. So I agree, it's not the form of social activism that we'll consider today by some authors of color, but it was also somehow dictated by their circumstances at the time.
Definitely. And that's something that we always have to kind of wrestle with, the undue burden that anyone who is Black or Latin or otherwise marginalized or minoritized is going to have that burden of having to be a spokesperson or kind of bear the burden of being the person who has to further their group's struggles, when obviously white authors and white artists can exist without that burden. And that's why looking at kind of, this is my area more, but looking at whiteness studies in convergence with Black and Latinx studies and seeing how whiteness is kind of unnamed and unoperated, but it's still existing in a way that is constraining the existence of Black and Latinx authors, for example, who are forced to deal with these really hard struggles of identity and, you know, who they are and what they're doing and why their work matters, and having it to be some type of social commentary for it to matter, I think is definitely something that you consider fully in your book. And then going off of that, you talk about how certain historical writers, publishers, consumers of this art or this work or these literatures have valued Black or Latinx literatures not necessarily for engaging with the larger questions of race, ethnicity, etc., but more for as their artistic or aesthetic merit, right? And then I'm thinking about, rather than the chapter we just talked about, more on chapter 4, where you talk about the work of Rodriguez and Ellison. And I'm wondering if you could talk about how the question of aesthetics and artistic merit impacted them and impacted the way that they approached writing.
Thank you for asking that question. And I think it's great question and an opportunity for me to come back to a premise or an idea that from the beginning, from the introduction or that starts the book when I try to argue that African-American authors, Latinx authors, whatever we want to think about the beginning of the tradition or when we start to incorporate those literatures into the larger American literature body or canon, they've always been in conversation with literary currents, concerns in the tradition. And I think Ellison is a good example of a person who tried, I believe, as hard as he could to be part of that tradition. And scholars have written books about this, how in his writing technique, his aesthetic vision, he tried to align himself with modernist authors. He'll forget modernism, or what one way to look at modernism as a period, it's something that I was familiar with, again, based on my training in American literature, my readings in American literature. But there was also a tension as from what we've been talking about of like how much to present your work and yourself and your experiences or what you write about. For I'm thinking about Invisible Men without engage with the social or discrimination or American history. But in their public persona as writers, I think Ellison was as much interested to, again, be aligned with mainstream American literature than being aligned with African-American literature. And what I will say briefly about Rodriguez is something very similar I found, or what I will consider is very similar that Richard Rodriguez, when I read him, Richard Rodriguez, one of like the perhaps the one Latinx Mexican American writer that I read as an undergrad. And not too long ago, I just found out that people, their first reading is Richard Rodriguez. So on the one hand, I found it very compelling that Richard Rodriguez got himself immersed in the American literary tradition. He wanted to read, he wanted to learn. And he, and as I believe as he progressed as a writer, he again, he wanted to be like a writer, a thinker, an intellectual, but not particularly a Mexican-American intellectual. And I think that's the tension because also he could not just, like you mentioned earlier, like he could not just present himself, I'm just one more American author, but like he will always have to come with this, but with this identity as a Mexican-American writer that people, regardless at the time, like also we were talking earlier, like in the 80s, late 70s, 80s and 90s, most often he will be asked to speak or write as an American, as a Mexican-American writer.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
The point about Ellison is interesting to me because, you know, Invisible Man is such a classic. It's one of the first, well, not one of the first, but I definitely remember reading it as a kid, like a pretty young kid when I was like 10 or 11. And it was like, oh, this is a classic. I had no idea that it was about race at all. I mean, I didn't start reading Black literature till I was a little bit older, like 12, 13. And then it was like, oh, this is a classic. And then later it was like, this is a social commentary on race is the next thing I learned about it, or that people kept saying, like, oh, it's this veiled allegory for race, for him as a Black man. And I was like, I don't see that at all. And then going to your work as, you know, him saying, you know, I want to be you know, an American writer, and I want to be judged by these standards. And I don't want people to look at my work as like a Black American work. I want it to be American, right? So that's kind of a weird trajectory. And I feel like that's a trajectory that a lot of Americans follow when it comes to this type of literature, where it's like, oh, this is American. Oh, no, it's Black. Oh, but it's American is what he wanted it to be, right? So my original kind of conception of it maybe was actually accurate, according to what Emerson might have wanted, or Ellison might have wanted. Not Emerson, that's a different person. So going back to, you kind of touched on this already, but your book is focused on not only, you know, literature itself, but then you talk a lot about the publishing processes, which as a media historian, I kind of do what you do too. And it's like, oh, this is the event of this person's life and this is the history. But then it's also, what are the processes? What are the industries? What are the production cultures that are surrounding the publication of whatever it was? And how did it come to be? And you talk about how that process is central to the inclusion or exclusion of certain work and the decisions that are made. So you talk about how the publishing industry is a white-dominated space that has allowed them to act as de facto gatekeepers for, again, publishing or not publishing certain works. And I was wondering if you could expand on that in terms of this project and how that affects your analyses of the Black and Latinx authors.
Oh, thank you again, and thank you for allowing me to discuss or mention the idea of the role of the publishing industry or literary production more broadly. So again, one of the things that I remember when I was starting to like when immersing on what I will consider the Latinx literary tradition, Puerto Rican authors, again, Cuban American authors, Mexican American, is that lack of publishing opportunities. But I remember also, as you were mentioning, when I read Charles Chestnut, might be as an undergrad trying to fill the gaps, or later on in English studies, in his struggles just to get published. And again, I think scholars today, like you say, recently, the last 20 years, they talk more about like literary production, like the means of literary production, who gets published, who gets excluded, who have those opportunities, how many people, like if we see like a group of like three or four women of color, we might think like, oh, the field is becoming so diverse or gender inclusive, when in reality it's like the same three or four. So since the beginning of earlier Mexican American authors pre-1960, it seemed to me like they also struggle with often with that idea of Rudolfo Anaya, for example. I remember he tried to get published by New York publisher, mainstream publishers, without any success. But like you mentioned, that these are case studies, but some of them, and through the moments in the literary tradition, Latinx literary tradition, it's a recurring theme. So I believe definitely literary production, the exclusion of authors of color, it's a result of larger forces, but it not only plays in the literature, but as you mentioned, I mean, it could be like in other sorts forms of media, and it happens today. And I talk to students often about this, and it's like it's there, like we see it every day, or students see. I mean, I myself, students and myself, we see it every day, but we seldom stop to consider why there's these tropes in film about Latinx people that we take it. Anyway, they're very few, they're very recurrent. And if we look back at the history of film or television, and the scholars have done this, like it's just come from a place of exclusion. And when people of color are included, I mean, it's the same, I believe, in African-American history or literature, they're included. It begins with this stereotypes or what white producers or white editors think that how Latinx or African American literature or film or people, black people in film should look like or perform.
Right. And that's this kind of hard process to account for where it's, oh, we have to use these stereotypes because that's what people recognize, right? To indicate that this is character is Latin or black. And then that reifies existing stereotypes and form stereotypes, but then is reinforced in kind of this cycle of violence, I guess you could even say, where there's no kind of way out. I mean, there's sort of a way out, there's sort of been some development, but a lot of scholars right now are also arguing, I'm thinking mostly of like black women scholars that I follow, are arguing that we need to move beyond the representational politics side of things. So like you mentioned in publishing, it's like, you know, Colson Whitehead and a few other authors are really dominating right now. And there's kind of this like white fragility feeling that, oh, if you're not black or a woman, you're not going to get published. I feel like there's that kind of sentiment, which is obviously ironic because it's never been true and out throughout history. But there's this kind of like, oh, they're black and they're a woman, and or they're black and or they're women or whatever it is. And I'm wondering how you've kind of thought about that, because you do talk about even just like the numbers of people who are getting published, you know, recently or back then. Like the kind of the essentialization of race is something I'm really interested in. Like, oh, by nature of their blackness, now they are a black author, and then they fit this kind of representational diversity quota that's happening. So I'm wondering how you've kind of thought about that or dealt with that in terms of like thinking about quote unquote progress. Like, is it sheer numbers? Like, oh, there were more black women authors in this past 2 years than there ever were, or something like that. You know what I mean?
From the 1960s onward, or I'll start with what I don't know was clear to me at the beginning also, or as I developed the project or the book, is that I found that also based on what we've been discussing, it seems to me like from the 60s to the 2000s, it was hard for most African American authors. Again, we talk about Ralph Ellison, like we were talking about, like if Invisible Man is about race or it isn't, or is he talking about social issues? Latinx authors, some Latinx authors and African American authors, I thought it was expected, or they couldn't escape engaging with social issues and like fights for representation and inclusion and social justice for their particular communities. But I will agree that, for example, after the 2000, and that's what some of the scholars write about, is like we cannot keep writing about, like you say, right, like perpetuate or like holding on to like certain narratives. And I think in the past 2-3 decades, definitely it's more a concerned effort either or by both authors of color and scholars to look beyond, right? Like not everything is about fight against for civil rights. Not everything is against depicting aesthetically the horrors of Jim Crow segregation, of marginalization of Mexican Americans in the Southwest at the start of the 20th century. So I agree with that argument. I think authors of color today have more opportunities to move in different directions. But when it comes to the publishing industry, like you say, and this is also that I read recently, I believe in the New York Times, that now we're coming into like authors of color need to play certain scenes. One that I remember is like the police stop scene that now like in a lot of narratives, it's coming present. And I find it an interesting permutation of the narratives that writers of color describe, engage, but I don't know how you were discussing earlier, how easy it's to move away to those narratives when there's still most authors of colors at the mercy of like larger forces. Like, they need to get published, they need to find an agent, they would like to get an advance for their work and things like that.
Right. And it's like, in the past, the narrative of police brutality would be erased or not be able to be told at all. And now it can be told, but then now what's happening is it's kind of getting commodified, and, you know, it's like they're deploying these stories, and then it's the narrative of Black pain. I don't know if you've seen that kind of discussion, like the fact that Netflix is obsessed with Black pain, like people who are African or African descendants having this kind of narrative of they are in pain or they are going to be experiencing pain. And then it's kind of the sensationalized description and depiction of Black suffering that people, a lot of people in the Black community specifically, are fighting against. So it's like, how do you win kind of deal? Because we don't want those stories to be overlooked or just ignored, obviously. We need there people to know that black pain and suffering is happening because of police brutality and other forces. But is that the only thing that's happening, right? And then you have the Black joy kind of like counter to that, that's trying to reclaim humanity. It's like there's the whole scale of human experience there. So yeah, that's a question I haven't remotely been able to find an answer to. But yes, it's complicated. Speaking of which, as we're kind of talking about events that are happening right now and where this book ended up for you, and if it's kind of leading into other projects, are you working on anything now, either with your teaching or with your research, that's kind of percolating?
Yeah. When I was writing, I remember a chapter in the book about what we were talking earlier about the history of literary production, the influence of publishers, the publishing industry. I realized that there are several scholars out there of Black literary studies, Latinx literary studies, that they're focused on either Spanish language print culture or Black print culture, and do kind of like the creative intellectual work that wasn't allowed by mainstream publishers. And also these scholars, I think they're trying to counteract the idea of that what we think of literary production. I mean, the way they, I believe, most kind of information works, like you look at the literature, you look at the works, even the Western canon, the American literary canon, all the older, the pre-60s literary canon, but not everything is just book production. So although, like you mentioned, like I touch on that, I try to describe that in the book, I'm just very interested these days about like what other scholars are doing in this regard, like discovering, like for example, one example that I'm amazed by, John Moran Gonzalez's work, Border Renaissance, in which he talks about Mexican American civil rights organizations in LULAC, the League of Latin American, I'm looking out on the acronym, but they come with Lula News, and they're they describe that it's a vehicle for Mexican American authors to write about civil rights and write fiction and write poetry. So these days, what I'm interested in is like continue in that line of investigation. Because there are a lot of, again, also these stories have been told in different works. I think what I like to of part of the work I do is like a synthesis of like different developments or like different Mexican-American authors. Alfonso Perales, for example, Arturo Schamber in New York City at the turn of the 20th century, and even a little bit earlier, Jose Marti. But all of these authors, again, although some of them published, like Jose Marti actually was able to be published in New York City, the bulk of their work in the U.S. context comes from print culture and newspapers.
Yeah, I just looked that book up when you were talking. Texas, 1930s, The League of United Latin American Citizens, LULAC.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's actually what my doctoral advisor, Michael Fulhag, studies, is Mexicans in Anglo relations, kind of in the north or in the southwest region of the United States, in terms of print culture, because he's a journalist. And that's kind of what I do a little bit, Cuba news production in the 1800s, early 1800s mostly. I'm looking at those print cultures. So that's really interesting. There's a lot of good stuff that's happening right now, I think, in that area. So that's going to be really exciting to see kind of where that takes you. Well, this was great. Hopefully everyone's able to pick up the book, read, and see kind of what the specifics are of your argument. And thanks so much for joining me today and talking about your book.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Till next time.